This is Dr. Karen Wilson-Starks, and welcome to my podcast series, The Voice of Leadership. What if there is a profitable return on empathy in the corporate work environment? My guest today will share his insights on how a culture of compassion enhances the bottom line, the value of creating a diverse executive team, and how to unlock millennial magic to attract bright young minds who will drive the future. Neil Frick is the CEO of CyberCore Technologies, a cybersecurity company that specializes in secure supply chain management. He has also held other corporate and leadership positions in retail business and government contracting. Neil's business results include restructuring and reducing overhead by $2.5 million, tripling headcount and revenue within 2 years, and reducing attrition from 35% to 8% within 12 months. The author of the book, The E-Suite, Empathetic Leadership for the New Generation of Executives, Neil grounds his approach to leadership in the power of empathy and investment in people. His father modeled this ethos when he took personal responsibility for an employee grappling with drug addiction, paying for the employee's rehab, and welcoming him back to work once sober. His father's actions deeply impacted Neil, instilling a lifelong conviction about the inherent value of people over profits, and the understanding that investing in people leads to inevitable profits. With insights sharpened in the crucible of personal experience and professional success, Neil is on a mission to build a community of empathetic leaders. Welcome, Neil, to the Voice of Leadership and to Dr. Karen Speaks Leadership.
Thank you so much, Dr. Karen. I appreciate you having me on.
I am delighted to have you on. I love what you're doing in terms of empathy in the workplace. It kind of fits with my notion of positive leadership in the workplace as well. So you and I really share something in common or on a similar page in that respect. So I want to jump right in, Neil, and just start asking you about this backstory with your father, because he was your number one role model for empathy in the workplace. So tell us a little bit about your father's business and a little bit more about what he did for that employee who was struggling with the drug addiction.
Certainly. So my father is an insulator, general contractor, and started his own business, very small, him and a few other guys. And one of those employees of his, over the course of their working together, developed a drug addiction and was having some pretty significant personal issues after going through a divorce. And my father really valued this individual, and not just his work, but also just him as a person. And from a very early age, I saw what it was like when a boss takes genuine interest in an employee and helps them through a difficult time. It would have been very easy for him to just, you know, say, thank you so much for your work, but this is no longer working, and move on. And instead, he modeled a very different approach.
And what ultimately happened to that employee that he helped in the workplace?
They are still working together 25 years later.
Oh, what a blessing. Okay, so that's a great testimony of the value of the empathetic approach. What other examples did you see from your father in his business? What else does he do to show empathy in the workplace where you saw that modeled for you?
Certainly. I think, you know, he has a very kind of community-centric approach to his organization. He decided to stay small, partially because he wanted to spend more time with his family. He didn't want to kind of get out over his skis, but partially also because I think he really appreciated the personal touch that he was able to have, not just with his team members, but also with his customers. He knows each and every one of the people that he contracts for very well, and typically very closely. They were in and out of our home when I was a child. He became friends with a number of them. His approach, I found, after I got into kind of a more traditional business setting myself, was not the typical approach, and was somewhat surprised by that. But I think that that is how he really kind of modeled that for me when I was younger.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, how you've taken what you learned from your father and taken it to the next level. Talk about how your father's example impacts how you lead today. What are you doing as a result of seeing what he did, and how have you extended it?
Absolutely. I think I have tried my best to live up to the example that he set, in that there is serious opportunities within business, especially within the United States, to help high performers continue to be high performers. Everyone goes through significant personal issues. Not one of us has not been impacted by something terrible, and especially after coming out of this pandemic and seeing what terrible situations people have gone through and the impact it's had on their work life. You know, we let people struggle when we could extend a hand in help. And I think that is something that we miss a trick on, and something I try within reason to do when I am leading an organization or leading a team.
You know, it's challenging, I'm sure, because sometimes it may not always work out in the way that you hope it would work out. So say a little bit about that, because there's some people who are wondering, you know, is this empathy thing really profitable? Is it the way to go? To what extent do maybe some employees maybe exploit the system rather than benefit from the empathy?
I think it's important to define empathy in a business setting. And really, empathy is about understanding another person's emotional state and contextualizing that to make decisions. It's not sympathy, and it's not niceness. It is another avenue of information for you to gather before you make an informed decision. It can be misapplied. And what I find that nice bosses tend to misapply empathy, because niceness comes from a desire to avoid conflict and make everybody like you, whereas empathy comes from a desire to understand what someone's going through and then see if there is a reasonable way to accommodate them and make their situation better. Where I think people get that negative impression of empathetic leadership is that they see it misapplied, and they see people use it to give people who are acting poorly another chance and another chance and another chance. And that's really not what it's about.
Well, say a little bit more about that, about not giving another chance, another chance. How do you determine when to use empathy in a certain situation, and maybe when you've extended enough and it's time to do something else? That's a tough call for a lot of business leaders. How do you know?
It's a bit of a gut check, but I think it's also, I'll give you an example. I had a high performer, someone who was incredible, did wonderful things for the organization from a revenue standpoint, but ultimately was incredibly disruptive to the culture within the organization. He was going through a very tough personal time. He had a lot of demons that he was fighting. I let that go on for too long. One, because of my natural inclination to try to help a top performer continue to perform. And two, because we had built a very strong friendship. But what I found was that my sympathy for him and my kindness were overriding what I knew I needed to do, which was to find an exit for him from the organization. And empathy gave me the knowledge of what he was going through, but it also gave me information about what his actions were doing to the rest of the organization. And the niceness, the sympathy is what overcame that and said, well, that's not as important, and I'm going to make sure that he continues to perform well. From my perspective, empathy is contextual, and then how you apply it is really, you have to look holistically at your organization and make sure that there are, you know, that everyone is driving in the same direction, and you're not allowing one person to override what is fair to others.
Well, it sounds like you're making some decisions that have to do with the climate of the company in general. In other words, here was a person who was performing well in terms of the business metrics. However, culturally, they were doing some things that didn't fit. So it sounds like there are multiple buckets you have to evaluate to determine, is retention the best choice in this case? Or are there some other options that maybe I need to consider? So maybe help us with that a little bit. When might you decide that retaining the employee is really not in the best interest of the company or other people in the company, and that perhaps even with empathy in place, the better choice and decision is to help them exit, as you were saying?
Certainly. I think it comes down to whether or not the individual is willing to make the changes that they need to make to offset the challenging situation. So if they are causing cultural issues within an organization because they are not getting along with their peers or they're overly aggressive in their salesmanship, if they're willing to have a conversation around it, if they're willing to be led and to be mentored, then I think if they're a top performer, you owe it to them to give them an opportunity. But you also need to rigidly bound that with performance metrics. If things do not improve within a certain period of time, action needs to be taken. And, you know, in the specific case that I mentioned before, I failed, frankly, in setting those performance metrics. And had I, from the beginning, used my understanding of his emotional situation through that empathetic leadership to craft a performance improvement plan that included those cultural touch points that I needed him to hit, perhaps it would have had a better outcome. So I think termination and moving someone out of an organization is really kind of your last, hopefully your last solution. But realistically, you know, some organizations just don't work for certain people. And sometimes people reach kind of the end of their lifespan within an org, and everyone needs to accept that and gracefully move through it.
Wonderful. So I think a lot of executives out there hearing this say, yeah, we agree with what you're talking about. That's probably what we would do too. And I think the flip side, and maybe some of what you're talking about, is that there are people who can be salvaged. And in a lot of organizations, those people would be thrown out to pasture, so to speak, maybe prematurely. So talk a little bit about, how do you tell when maybe salvaging a person is the better way to go? What are the signs that you look for to determine when to make that kind of an investment?
I find that when performance starts to drop from someone who has historically been a strong performer, or even not necessarily the strongest, but a consistent performer, and there are no changes in tools, in environmental situation within the organization, it tends to be an issue of morale or an issue of personal challenges. And what we tend to do as leaders sometimes is come into that situation with preconceptions about what the issue is. We may think it is someone who is just skating, you know, they're not as interested in performing anymore. We may think that their personal situation is overwhelming their professional situation and make judgments. I would recommend to leaders going in with a more open attitude and fostering an environment where people feel comfortable talking about mental health issues, family issues, situations that they have going on, because we all go through them, and have a human-to-human conversation around, hey, what do you need to be successful here? You know, we've noticed that things aren't going as well. If your personal situation has changed, is there something that we can do? Offer more flexibility, change your hours. More than not, people want to be successful and they want help to be successful. And if we offer that, we can salvage those people rather than pushing them out the door.
Yeah, I love that, because when you think about it, I mean, human resources are very valuable. And it's like, I know this is going to be a weird analogy, but let's say you could even have an older car, like I love older cars, that you want to preserve. And you could throw it out the pasture if you want to, or you could take good care of it. You can get it repaired and keep it for a long time, and it can still be of great service. And sometimes we're in a throwaway culture that doesn't think about how can something be salvaged and utilized still even though it may be older or it may have issues, it can still be of good service. And so what you're saying is it's almost like recycling, or it's kind of like in that vein, how can we still get value here and build the person up too at the same time, is what I hear you talking about.
I think it builds loyalty. I think it builds trust in the organization. You know, people talk a lot about sort of the great resignation post-COVID. They talk a lot about how the younger generation doesn't have the same loyalty to organizations now. And a lot of the reason that they don't is because organizations don't have the same loyalty to them. As you said, we have a throwaway kind of culture now. If something isn't working, we don't expend the energy to fix it. We just say, all right, well, we're going to get something new. And when it comes to people, if someone wants to be successful and they have the aptitude, that is all a good leader needs. If you can take someone and give them the hard skills, you can take someone and teach them what they need, you can mentor them, you can refine their communication style, but you can't create ambition within a person. So if you have someone with the good raw materials, you know, that's not even empathetic leadership. It's just common sense. You want to try to foster and give them an environment in which they can thrive, because that helps the bottom line in the organization.
So yeah, here's something here that makes me think about the partnership between the leader and the employee. In this sense, the employee is bringing some skills and abilities, obviously, as you're saying, they learn on the job as well. They can be taught some things. However, there's that motivation part where you said most people want to do well. They want to do a good job. And so the people you're investing in this way, they at least have that at the core or the nucleus of their motivation. And then you can build around it, is what I'm hearing you say. So this empathy thing, it works especially if people have some internal motivation and they're willing to do their part of whatever the fix is to get to a different place.
It is certainly a two-way street, and people do have to realize that they have an obligation to themselves to better themselves, to seek out mentorship, to grow. You know, not everyone is cut out for kind of a traditional business role, and that's fine. You know, it takes all kinds. But for those who are interested and who are willing to put in that work and are willing to have those conversations around what they need without fear, which usually takes an environment where they can feel that way, they are the ones who you want to reinvest in and make sure that you're growing, because they're going to be the ones that will stay with your organization the longest and be the most successful. You know, the organization I'm running now, CyberCorps, we have great success with an internship program that has taken people from, you know, helping out in the IT room all the way through into software and systems engineering, where in 10 years, they've completely changed the trajectory of their career, and we've created a program to do so. You know, those kinds of things are what makes companies successful these days.
Oh, I love the fact that you are sharing ways that you're building into people, and you're talking about CyberCorps. Let's deviate just a little bit, and I want to talk about CyberCorps for a minute, and then I want to come back to some of the people things. What does your company do? Who are your clients in the sense of who do you help? How do you serve them? Tell us a little bit about cybersecurity.
Certainly. So CyberCorps is a government contractor. Our primary customer is the intelligence community of the United States. So a lot of the three-letter agencies. We do cybersecurity, infrastructure security, and supply chain security for those customers. Essentially, purchasing, safeguarding the IT infrastructure, the systems that do some really cool and interesting things in the national interest, kind of safeguarding our nation's security.
So when we think about cybersecurity, one of the big issues nowadays is this whole thing about artificial intelligence, AI. And recently in the news, there have been some videos that came out that were fake and that were false and given a message that those real individuals would not have wanted to put out there. So talk to us a little bit about what some of the challenges are that are kind of new or front and center in the cyberspace, and particularly as it relates to AI.
Well, I think that, you know, the internet is a wonderful thing, but it's also somewhat of a dangerous thing. Our adversaries overseas, people who want to do harm to the U.S., and really in any country, anyone's adversaries, they look at the internet as a battleground, as a way to leverage information, to sow dissent, to cause division, to push their end game forward. And AI has allowed for a lot of disinformation that would have been significantly more manpower intensive 20 years ago. To fake a video of that quality would have taken a team of individuals quite a long time. And now it's pretty much a push of a button. So I think one of the challenges we're going to face as video and photo technology advances and artificial intelligence advances in writing and citing sources, verifying factual information is going to be really key. I've said for a long time, don't trust anything you read on the internet. Never have truer words been spoken than right now. This is one of the most dangerous times for information. And I'm sure you see it, you know, you read an article and you go, is that real? It seems real. It seems to be it's written by someone, but it's entirely possible that all of the sources are, you know, created artificially. There's no verification or validation of information. It is definitely something that we have to be very vigilant about as we kind of move forward and keep ourselves informed.
Well, thank you for sharing that information. Maybe share a couple of strategies that people can use to keep safe in a cyber sense. You mentioned about verifying information. Maybe give some examples. How can they verify information? What are one or two other things they can do that would make a difference?
Some of it is obvious that, you know, never open an email from someone that you don't know. Never even answer a phone call from someone that you don't know. Make sure that your voicemail is set up that doesn't give out your full name. You want to try to restrict the information that you have out in the world as much as possible. Don't put personal identifying information out onto social media. Don't allow connections from anyone who you do not know on social media. There are somewhat common sense solutions. The more nuanced ones are more complicated. There are a number of organizations out there that can safeguard your computer equipment, you know, antivirus software and anti-spam software. But where people tend to fall into the trap more often than not is in that human-to-human communication. Somebody gets you on the phone and they have this much information about you, so you certainly start to feel comfortable, and then all of a sudden you give them more and they have what they need to steal your identity. Or they send you an email and the name of it is a very good friend of yours, but the actual email address itself is spoofed from overseas and they're trying to get information from you. I would just say, when it comes to communication and anything that you are reading online, just take the extra step to verify. And if you're reading something that, you know, seems odd, look for other sources that are reputable, that you know you can trust, whatever your personal, you know, if you're a New York Times reader or a Post reader or whatever, verify that information before you take it as truth.
Well, those are very good tips. I already heard a thing or two that I can change today. So thank you for that information. One of the things I've noticed is that those who are sending the fake emails, they've gotten better at it than what used to be the case. In the past, it was so easy to spot them. They weren't written very well, and there were all kinds of other telltale signs. And now you have to really be careful in order to detect that there is a fraudulent email in the inbox. So thank you for reminding us.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, especially from, so we're, as a government contractor, we are targeted quite often for cyber attack. And we're certainly targeted from a lot of phishing scams as well. The most recent thing I've seen is a lot of like Adobe e-signature documents that look very real. They look like they come from your auditor or from your CFO. And you have to be very vigilant about those links because, as you said, they're much more creative these days. And with artificial intelligence, the writing is now much more cogent because it has much more to pull from. It is not people whose English is not their first language crafting these. It's getting harder and harder to tell them apart from real legitimate emails.
Thank you, Neil, for keeping us all safe in what you do every day and even what you just shared right now. So I want to take a step back and go back to this whole notion. Business people, business executives especially, really do care about profitability and business results, and so do you, and you've had some stellar results, and I really want to unpack a few of those. One of the things I mentioned earlier is that you restructured and reduced overhead by $2.5 million. Tell us how you did that.
So when I took over as CEO of CyberCore 2 years ago, we had experienced quite a lot of challenging times during COVID, as most organizations did. And it was really time for kind of a full restructuring and reorg. Personally, my least favorite part of my job is anything to do with personnel reductions. So we looked at tools, efficiencies, redundancies, and are there individuals within the organization that if they had a new toolkit could take on additional responsibility? And what we ended up doing was taking individuals who were overhead, shifting them into revenue generating positions where possible. So you kind of get that twofold of you cut your overhead costs and you increase your revenue on the back end. And that really took understanding where people were and what they were willing to do, and then working with them to find more efficient solutions to challenges that they were facing.
What I love about that is you didn't just take the easy answer like so many companies do. Well, let's just chop this many people, this many heads, so to speak. You looked a little more deeply at where could people be redeployed? How could they be adding value to the company, which probably took a little more time. Yet at the same time, you are preserving talent and you're using that talent in a profound way and increasing, as you said earlier, the loyalty of those personnel, because they certainly know they could have been cut or they could have been chopped instead.
Absolutely. It took a good year, I would say, which is a little bit longer than I think most people like to take, but I felt that a thorough analysis division by division was really important. Now, don't get me wrong, we did end up doing some layoffs as sort of part and parcel with the reorganization, but those were very informed. They were not siloed decisions based solely on financials. We took the cultural impacts into account. We took potential problem-solving issues into account. We took people's personal situations into account to some degree. And as a result, even though we did conduct a series of layoffs, we had no turnover as a result of it. People tend to get scared after layoffs and they move on. We didn't experience that. I feel like our culture is stronger than it's ever been. And our revenue, it continues to go up kind of quarter after quarter. So, I think the easy thing to do is to come into an organization and look at, all right, purely by the numbers, here's the revenue, here's the cost, here's what we can eviscerate. And, I've had consultants come in and make those recommendations. And in a vacuum, yes, the next day you go from not profitable to profitable. But 6 months later, a year later, your corporate team is left, your customers are unhappy, and you're experiencing a significant amount of brain drain because you didn't do it the right way. So I think that sometimes going slower and making those more deliberate decisions are really important.
Oh, yeah. And it increases and engenders trust of your people in you. Now, if they see you just come in with a hatchet and chop overnight and nobody understands that, that's frightening. And as you said, people will be less loyal in that situation. But when they see you be careful and deliberate and make wise choices and really consider options, that engenders a greater sense of loyalty rather than the fear of I could be next tomorrow.
And I think transparency is also very key there. We created a leadership team within the organization and employee-led culture committees that were empowered to make real change within the organization. And then we walked people through our thought process when it came to the changes that we were making. There are some things, obviously, that have to be held behind closed doors, but where we could, we shared that information, both from a sort of solicitation of creative ways to problem solve, but also so that people knew where we were coming from and knew that, we didn't make the decisions lightly. There was a thought process behind it. We did it for a reason, and they could see what the end game is. Because so often you are in a situation where you are part of an organization, but you don't know how you're contributing aside from this much of the value that you bring. When you are all driving in the same direction, it's much easier to feel that connection and then want naturally to stay longer and work harder.
Yeah, and I think that sharing the information you could share also addresses fear in an organization, because when people don't know what you're doing, why you're doing it, how you're doing it, and they don't have enough information, fear increases. And of course, we already talked about trust being eroded. And as that happens, they start making up their own answers for what's going on. And 9 times out of 10, those made up answers are worse than the reality of what's going on.
That is absolutely true. Fear thrives in darkness, and the only way to really do anything about it is to bring all of it into the light. We had a situation somewhat recently. It was sort of a cavalcade of different situations. A lot of the executive leaders had PTO at the same time. We also had a couple new contract wins. We were not as accessible for a period of about 2 weeks. And at the end of those 2 weeks, we had a pretty big customer come through and walk the building. And because there was a shift in our behavioral pattern, even though it was slight, all of a sudden there were these conversations around, oh, the company's being acquired, something's up, there's something new. And we realized, wow, we have to be very cognizant of what we're doing, how we're talking, what we're communicating. We can't really take a couple weeks and just do things differently. We have to be consistent, because when we don't, people start to get a little concerned. And it was really instructive to us to understand the power of that transparent communication.
Oh, yeah. And the predictability, because if you start acting different, then they think something different is really going on,
yep.
Even if it isn't. So,
right.
Very powerful concepts. So you also had some other business results too, Neil, about tripling headcount and revenue in a 2-year period of time. And you also reduced attrition from 35 to 8% in a year. Now, those are pretty remarkable kinds of results. So share more with us about how you did some of those other pieces as well.
So those were, I think, actually, when I came on board CyberCorps initially, I was the head of talent acquisition. My background is in recruiting and talent acquisition. And we created a career path, I think we called it Compass, basically setting your own direction. We set up certification incentive plans, education reimbursement programs, an internal lab where people could come and play around with technology that they hadn't experienced before to get hands-on exposure to how things work. And we then looked at our benefits and compensation plans and said, okay, they need a refresh. And hired a few individuals to come in as employee liaisons and program managers whose focus was mobility within the organization and growing individuals. We've really tried to make this a place where, kind of like 40 years ago, when you could go to a company, you could work there for 30 to 40 years and retire from it with all of these new skills and experience. We really wanted to make it a company that you could do different things at and kind of experience the full breadth of cybersecurity. And as a result, yes, we were able to hire over 100. When I started, we had maybe 160 people. We grew to 300 in about 2 years. And as a result of our services business growing, we tripled that revenue, and we went from close to 40% at one point attrition all the way down to single digit attrition.
Wow, that is truly amazing, because you made your workplace interesting for the employees where they could continue to grow and develop. They weren't going to be doing the same thing all the time, yes, every day. And so they didn't have to move to another company, because within the company, they had opportunity. I think that's brilliant. And more people probably should do more of that in order to have success.
I agree. I think, you know, we have this tendency when someone's really good at their job, we don't want them to go anywhere because they're so good. How are we going to replace that person? How are we going to find somebody who can do what they do? But they're going to get bored. We're humans. We need stimulation. We need new things. So they're going to move on. And it's more risky to an organization to lose someone talented than promote or move someone talented. It also costs us more money to hire than it does to retain. So from a purely numbers standpoint, it makes sense to reinvest in your employees, because they are what's driving your customer satisfaction and they are what's driving your profit.
That is the truth. And this is reminding me of another area where I know you have expertise, and that is in really engaging the younger people in the organization, the millennials, the ones who are going to be the leaders replacing the baby boomers and others sometime soon. So What have you learned about engaging those younger leaders in the workplace? What has worked? And think about what other companies aren't doing that makes a difference.
Oh, you know, something that I've realized, millennials and especially Gen Z and, you know, the newer generations that are entering the workplace have experienced somewhat of an unprecedented level of access to other people. You know, all of this social media, TikTok and all, they have the ability to be heard by hundreds, if not thousands, of people on a daily basis. And there's an expectation that they be heard. When I was growing up, you know, children were to be seen and not heard. And now kids today and young adults today have a very different perspective. And I think there's some pushback from older generations about, you know, you've got to earn your place in the organization. You have to earn your voice. And those are still valid. But there's also no harm in opening the aperture to new ideas and experiences from someone who is entering the workforce or a younger leader. Give people the opportunity to have their voice heard. Give them the opportunity to contribute. Help them understand and give them boundaries so that they can be successful. But don't say, you know, be quiet and color for 6 years, and then you can start to have an opinion. The world has changed a little bit, and they're very used to being heard. And I think we can foster that. We can boundary it, but we can foster it.
I think it's so huge. I'm thinking now, this is a long time ago, but many years ago when I was active duty in the Army, and one of my assignments was with the cadets at West Point. And in the summer, we ran a mental health operation for cadet basic training. And I had first class cadets as, in essence, my direct reports. Now, the way officers led at the time would be simply to just tell them what to do. And that was it. And I said, look, these guys are about to graduate out of the academy. They're going to be leading people in real life. And they need to exercise their brains and thinking through tough decisions, because we had very tough decisions every day. And so in our morning case conference meeting every day, I would solicit, now, what would you do here? How would you handle this? And so while I'm there to be the mentor and also help them see what they wouldn't see, they're also stretching their brains and learning how to analyze and make tough decisions as leaders. And if you don't practice, then you're not going to be good when you first get out there. And you could have been practicing under safer conditions. So I think it's important.
Absolutely. It's teaching critical reasoning and critical thinking skills. It's helping to expand their confidence, which is incredibly important. And the reality is, you know, with the exception of the military or organizations that are doing active healthcare, there's not a lot of risk in letting someone fail. You know, obviously in certain organizations, there is some risk, but in most businesses, failure is not a terrible thing, especially if it's boundaried. But I think back to, you know, when I was young in my recruiting career, I had a lot of ideas about what would work. And I learned over time what did and what didn't. And I see young recruiters coming in with a lot of similar ideas to what I had when I was younger. And my inclination is to shortcut it and tell them, here's why that's not going to work. And sometimes if there's a cost investment, that's what I'm going to do because I'm not going to spend the money. But if there's no cost investment or there's not a lot of risk, I'm going to let them find out on their own and then help build them up afterwards and reinforce that I did the exact same thing. And the reason, you know, I got that question, well, why did you let me do it? Well, first of all, it's been 20 years since I was a recruiter, so things might have changed. And second of all, that's how I learned. That's how I got to where I am, is because I fell on my face and then I got back up.
Mm-hmm. That's really important. Really being willing to let people learn from mistakes, because it's all part of the process along the way. And I also think we can help them by asking some really good questions that are kind of open-ended, and it's based on the experiences and knowledge that we have, questions they may not have thought about. And so we might say, well, what are your plans, or what would you do if in implementing this X, Y, and Z happens? At least they're thinking about it and they're coming up with a pathway forward if X, Y, and Z happens. And they might not have even considered that X, Y, or Z could happen. So I think that's an excellent way to go too.
There's no harm in listening to someone's suggestion or opinion, even if they're not right. That's okay. They you have then an opportunity to have an educational conversation around why it won't work. And if you're a transparent leader, it gives you teaching opportunities every single day. But it takes maybe 2 minutes to lend an ear. And the trust that you build with that person when they see that you are trying to help them and that you're really giving them a chance to express themselves, it's enormous. And it's why a lot of companies are having significant attrition issues with millennials and Gen Zers, because they're applying sort of archaic business practices that they're just not tolerating. And there's a lot of opportunity out there. And so we need talented workers. We need to grow them. We need to advance their careers, because we're not going to be around forever. And we need to be able to pass the torch to a generation that has critical thinking skills, that has critical reasoning skills, and can do what we do, because that's the legacy that we should leave behind.
Absolutely. Anything else about the millennials or the Gen Zers or younger generation you haven't mentioned yet that you think other executives really need to think about?
You know, I think the only other thing I would say is I hear a lot that these younger generations have a lot of entitlement issues, right? They think they deserve something. And I would challenge executives, because it's something I go through myself, to ask yourself why you think you didn't deserve that when you were younger. Because looking back, you probably did. You probably did deserve a voice at the table. You probably did deserve fair and equitable wages. You probably did deserve a second chance if you made a mistake. Just because we were brought up in certain environments, just because we were taught a certain way, doesn't necessarily mean it was right. Now, I will caveat that with, yes, sometimes there are entitlement issues, and sometimes that can be frustrating, so I'm not invalidating that, but I would just challenge people to be a little bit more open, because I think there are things that we can learn from this generation. Their connectivity and their knowledge of how other people, other organizations do things have given them a wider worldview than we had at their age.
Oh, that's great. I'm so glad you talked about that. Neil, I also know that you are very committed to diversity and to the power of diversity in the success of organizations. And when you came to your company, you had an executive team of 6 white males. Tell us what you did to transform that team and what's been the result.
Well, I will say it was made up of men and women, but yes, it was, we were all white. So as part of the reorganization, we reduced our executive team, but then we eliminated it. And instead, I opened it up to a leadership team that I think is more representative of the world at large. Men, women, people of different ethnicities, backgrounds, socioeconomic classes. Personally, I want to see the organization that I work for represent the world around me. People of different races, colors, genders. It's important to me that the company is more reflective of my worldview. But I'm also really interested in diversity of thought. People who are raised differently, who think differently, who problem solve differently, because that really lends to creative solutions to problems that organizations miss out on when they homogenize their culture. People talk about fitting into an organization's culture, and I would challenge people to look for individuals that expand your organization's culture.
From what I'm hearing, making the team broader and more diverse has actually led to some unique thinking and ability to solve tougher challenges, is what I'm hearing.
And I will say that I think people who are part of marginalized groups have had to work harder and work differently in front of obstacles that people who look like me do not have. And whether whether people agree with that or not, I think it's inarguable that they have to approach things differently. And that gives you a different set of tools for solving a problem. And that is critical to an organization. You need to be able to attack something from all sides. And if you have 5 or 6 people who are all the exact same, coming from the exact same background, you're only going to have one solution to that problem.
That's just well stated and well said. And I know your company has the profitability results to talk about the value of becoming more diverse, in today's world. So, Neil, tell us a little bit about your book, The E-Suite, Empathetic Leadership for the Next Generation of Executives. What's in there that we haven't talked about yet, let's say? And who did you write it for? And if somebody reads it, what are they going to get out of it?
Certainly. So it is kind of a labor of love between myself and a coworker, a previous boss of mine, Tina Kuhn, who's my co-author. We wrote it because we realized that while we had very different approaches to problem solving, they were both rooted in this kind of people-first empathetic leadership. In the book are practical solutions to commonplace business problems, everything from kind of tactical issues of how do you recruit and retain? How do you sell? How do you market? And all kind of wrapped up in that people-based empathetic leadership approach. And then there's also, how do you transformationally change an organization but maintain some level of sanity during it? How do you make sure that your team stays on board? How do you manage difficult people? How do you have confrontational conversations while still maintaining everyone's dignity and making sure that you are communicating effectively, knowing as much as you can by leveraging that empathy? So there's a lot of really kind of practical frontline solutions. And I would say it's for anyone who wants to learn how to connect more deeply with their employees to make a positive change, anybody who wants to connect more with their customers, and anybody who wants their companies to experience revenue growth.
Ooh, that's a lot of people.
Yeah, exactly.
It sounds like a great book. That sounds like a great book. So how can people find out more about you and get the book?
So the book is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. The website is theesuite.com. And then me personally, I'm on Instagram at theanxiousceo1. And I use that moniker because I talk a lot about mental health. I'm an anxious person. And on Medium at neil.frick, where I write more short form articles about mental health and leadership, business ethics, and diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Wow. So you have quite an influence and a wide swath of subjects that you are covering. So I'm glad you're sharing that with people so that they can go to those sites and learn more. So Neil, what additional words of wisdom do you want to leave for my community of corporate executives? Maybe something you haven't said just yet.
I would say that it takes less time than you think, and it takes no money to have a conversation with someone and understand where they're coming from. It really is not that difficult to operate empathetically. Although people kind of think of it as a softer skill, there is real evidence around the power of it in growing your business. But the first thing that you have to do is you kind of have to put your ego aside, because you're going to have conversations with people who have different viewpoints than you do, who think differently, who approach things differently, who have different opinions. And they're going to, if you allow them, they're going to challenge you. And that will help you grow as a leader. It'll help them grow as an employee. It'll set them up for leadership. Depending on the industry that you work in, businesses tend to be a very ego-focused area, because it's very about what I can contribute. And then as you're a leader, it's about how I can change an organization. Open that aperture, let more people in, grow your community, diversify your community, and you will see results.
That's wonderful guidance. And what it reminds me of is the two-way process of learning. Just because you may be the executive doesn't mean you can't learn from the millennial or the Gen Z or whoever else is in the workplace. And I think if everyone has that learner's mind and attitude, the company is going to grow and be more successful, rather than to think it's just a one-way street. It's in both directions, is really what you're talking about, Neil.
Absolutely. I am a firm believer that no one is an expert. You know, they say 10,000 hours in anything makes you an expert. I don't believe that, because if you are truly an expert and you have nothing left to learn, then in my opinion, move on to something new. Because if you're not learning, what are you doing? But there's always, especially when it comes to our businesses, as the world evolves, we have to evolve. So, you know, listen to someone who is maybe not someone that you would typically take advice from. If it doesn't resonate, throw it away, but give someone the opportunity in the same way that you are trying to teach and mentor. Give them an opportunity to teach you something as well.
Thank you so much, Neil. Thank you for being here. Thank you for sharing so much wisdom that's practical and that people can use today, and really marrying empathy with the profitability of the company, because they do both go together.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. I enjoyed our conversation.
Me too. So thank you again. And so today, to everyone out there, end our conversation today with some scriptures that come from 1 Kings, the 12th chapter. And this is the situation where Rehoboam, who was the son of King Solomon, is now taken over as king because his father has died. And he has an opportunity to lead the northern tribes as well as the southern tribes if he makes the right empathetic choice. And so what we're going to read today is what really happened, what he decided, and a little bit about what happened. So in 1 Kings, the 12th chapter, and it starts off saying, "And Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all Israel had gone to Shechem to make him king. So it happened when Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, heard it, he was still in Egypt, for he had fled from the presence of King Solomon and had been dwelling in Egypt." So keep in mind, Jeroboam is kind of like the de facto leader of the northern tribes, but he's in exile in Egypt until Solomon dies. Now that he hears that Rehoboam, Solomon's son's in place, he comes back on the scene. And so here's where we pick that up. And then he says that they sent and called him. "Then Jeroboam and the whole assembly of Israel came and spoke to Rehoboam, saying, 'Your father made our yoke heavy. Now, therefore, lighten the burdensome service of your father and his heavy yoke which he put on us, and we will serve you.' So he said to them, 'Depart for 3 days, then come back to me.' And the people departed. Then King Rehoboam consulted the elders who stood before his father Solomon while he still lived, and he said, 'How do you advise me to answer these people?' And they spoke to him, saying, 'If you will be a servant to these people today and serve them and answer them and speak good words to them, then they will be your servants forever.' But he rejected the advice which the elders had given him and consulted the young men who had grown up with him, who stood before him. And he said to them, 'What advice do you give? How should we answer this people who have spoken to me, saying, lighten the yoke which your father put on us?' Then the young men who had grown up with him spoke to him, saying, 'Thus you should speak to this people who have spoken to you, saying, your father made our yoke heavy, but you make it lighter on us. Thus you say to them, my little finger shall be thicker than my father's waist. And now, whereas my father put a heavy yoke on you, I will add to your yoke. My father chastised you with whips, but I will chastise you with scourges.' So Jeroboam and all the people came to Rehoboam on the third day, as the king had directed, saying, 'Come back to me the third day.' Then the king answered the people roughly and rejected the advice which the elders had given him. And he spoke to them according to the advice of the young men, saying, 'My father made your yoke heavy, but I will add to your yoke. My father chastised you with whips, but I will chastise you with scourges.'" Now, you can read the rest of this, but what do you think those people did? The people from the northern kingdom ran away and said, "Forget it, we're not serving you." And so at that time, Rehoboam ended up being only in charge of the house of David in the southern part of the kingdom, and he lost the 10 northern tribes. And so this choice of whether you choose the empathetic leadership or the harsh scourge leadership makes a difference in terms of the success of your organization, the success in this case of the kingdom that Rehoboam was in charge of. So I think that Neil has done a great job of sharing with us the business benefit of empathy and how it leads to loyal employees, increases trust in the organization, and profitability. So the choice is yours. Decide for empathy and the success of your people and your company. See you next time. In some parts of the world, including the United States, loneliness, depression, and suicide are at an all-time high. With me today is Dr. Clarence Schuler, President and CEO of Building Lasting Relationships. He personally experienced a bout of depression. Dr. Schuler, tell us a little bit about what you learned in your experience and what resources you have available for us.
Well, mental health is a really big thing in America today, like you said, and African-American men are the number one depressed group in America, and I think men in general would come into that. And when I went through my depression, it was really a thing of idolatry. I hate to say that, but I was trying to validate myself by how much money I made or my success. And I was fortunate enough to have a Christian counselor, Dr. Monique Gadsden, who helped me work through that. So now I'm managing my depression more effectively. And so one of the resources that we have is our book, Finding Hope in a Dark Place, Facing Loneliness, Depression, and Anxiety with the Power of Grace. And so I hope you will use it as a resource just to see where you are emotionally. It's not a sin to be depressed. So I just want to encourage you and give you hope that your depression can be come under control.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Dr. Schuller. And what I want everyone to know, as he already said, this is a book that was co-written with his counselor. So it is the real deal. If you want to know more about the book or more about services that are available to deal with depression and loneliness, go to drclarenceschuller.com. That's clarenceschuller.com. Today, I'm here with Terrence Chatman, the president and CEO of nonprofit organization Victorious Family. They are committed to family discipleship and transformation. Thank you for being here, Terrence. Tell us about your big goal, what it is that you're going for at Victorious Family.
Well, by 2030, we see reaching 9.2 million families here in the U.S.
That is wonderful. And you're reaching these families because you really want to see children grow up and truly continue their faith in Christ. So tell us about one of your resources, Do Your Children Believe, the book you've written.
Well, Ephesians 6:4 says, fathers, don't exasperate your children, but to bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord. So we're just being faithful to that calling. In order to do that, we train coaches and we provide workshops and content to train parents on how to disciple their children.
That is phenomenal. So how can people find out more about the ministry and the other tools and resources you have available, and also how they can donate to support the ministry?
Well, one of those tools is Do Your Children Believe, a book that we've published by Thomas Nelson, and you can find that at victoriousfamily.org.
Fantastic. All right, so there you have it. You want your family to be victorious? Go to victoriousfamily.org. Hi, this is Dr. Karen here today, and I want to share some important insights with you about Spirit Wings Kids Foundation, a 501c3 organization that's doing wonders across the globe and especially in Uganda. And today I have with me Donna Johnson, who's the founder of Spirit Wings Kids and a member of the board. And today she's going to tell us about the permaculture farm that they have started. Donna, tell us all about it.
Thank you, Dr. Karen. For decades, we've been supporting the Orphanage and Family Network in Uganda. And in 2018, my son is a permaculturist, and we had acres that we dedicated to his planting. And it was just amazing. And he also taught them how to do permaculture. And it's flourishing. In fact, during the pandemic, it saved lives. 203 families were fed during the pandemic. And so it's such a miracle that God just called us to plant that garden at the time that we did.
Thank you so much, Donna. Thank you so much for your work in Uganda. And a couple of other things I want people to know. As a permaculture farm is self-contained in many ways, depending on how they're growing the crops, you don't have to use pest control, you don't need fertilizer. It's a very sustainable way to provide food for the community. And so that's a blessing. So if you want to be a part of this wonderful work out there, 100% of all of your donation goes to the people in Uganda to help feed them and their families. So go to swkids.foundation and give today. Make a difference in the world. And thank you for doing so. You've been listening to The Voice of Leadership with me, Dr. Karen Wilson-Starks. And I want to give a special thanks to jazz saxophonist Ron McMillan for granting us permission to use his gifted music on our show. Thanks for listening. And remember to go to my website, transleadership.com, for more strategies, insights, and leadership resources.